This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today we're joined by Jill Deacon, broadcaster, speaker, and author of this beautiful book. It's very dog-eared, A Love Affair with the Unknown, Leaning into the Uncertainty of Modern Life. As many of you know, Jill Deacon is a veteran journalist and broadcaster based in Toronto, Canada. Her voice is familiar, very familiar, to listeners of CBC Radio, where we heard her for many years on the CBC Radio program Here and Now. She's also a television host and journalist who has hosted television shows for CBC, Discovery Channel Canada, and Discovery Science Channel US. And in addition to the CBC, she's also hosted radio for NPR, Public Radio International, and Sirius XM. She's interviewed heads of state, Oscar winners, Olympians, rock stars, titans of industry, Pulitzer Prize winning authors, and everyone in between. Sometimes those are some of the best, right?
Oh, right.
And Jill is known for her ability to think on her feet, for her quick wit, and her lightning-fast live broadcasting chops that she's really honed over years of performing improvised sketch comedy. Jill's first book, Green for Life, was a national bestseller and spawned a column in Chatelaine magazine. Her follow-up book, There's Lead in Your Lipstick, Toxins in Our Everyday Body Care and How to Avoid Them. And that was an instant national bestseller and translated into several languages. Her memoir, Naked Imperfection, earned praise for its candor and humor, chronicling Jill's first experience with breast cancer. Her newest book, A Love Affair with the Unknown, was published in 2025. And Jill's writing has also appeared in many national publications, including The Globe and Mail, Chatelaine, Elle, Today's Parent, The Montreal Gazette, and CBC.ca. And of course, we'll talk about Substack as well. Jill has been an MC and host for dozens of live events and galas for tier one companies, organizations, and charities in a variety of sectors, including the arts, health, and urban affairs. Jill's also a sought-after keynote speaker who captivates audiences with her storytelling and insights on various topics. She's spoken at major conferences and seminars, sharing her expertise on media, environmental issues, health, and personal growth. In her latest book, A Love Affair with the Unknown, Leaning into the Uncertainty of Modern Life, Jill takes a refreshing look at the inevitability of uncertainty and how it can really help make the hard parts of life more manageable. Deacon explores the nature of uncertainty and shows how we can draw on our innate resilience to thrive in an ever-changing world. Like comedy, improvisation, and jazz, she reminds us that beauty often arises from the unpredictable. By revealing the value in not knowing, we don't always have to know, like the guest list, you say, and the who's going to be at the party. By not knowing, Jill makes a compelling case that uncertainty is a condition we're built for and that our greatest creativity, innovation, and connection emerge when we embrace it. Jill Deacon, longest bio in the history ever. I apologize. Congratulations on all of this and welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
And that's the end of the episode. Thank you, Judy. That is a humdinger of an intro.
I always say, if you've done all of this work, we have to say it. We have to talk about it. It's important.
I appreciate that.
Before we dive in, I just want to acknowledge also that you're joining us during a tender time, and I want to express all of our deepest condolences on the loss of your beloved mother, Theda.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's right. My mom died just a few days ago, but she lived a full life. She was 90, so it's not tragic, but as anybody who's lost a mom knows, it is sad one way or the other. There's no getting around it. So thank you for mentioning good old Theda. Yep. She was a special lady.
You wrote a beautiful thing. You wrote, said goodbye to this regal beauty today. For 90 years, Theda Deacon was the queen of quiet, gentle gestures and so, so much tender, loving care for her family and friends. Cook a delicious meal tonight in her honor. and be sure to put some flowers on your table.
Yep. That's my mom.
I'm so sorry for your loss. And, you know, when I was putting this whole thing together, I couldn't help wondering how, I know you had this lovely relationship with your mom, and I know you've talked also about the lovely relationship with your dad, and you've spoken about it, and you worshiped him. And I'm wondering, as I always do when I see someone as wonderful and as successful as you, how such a well-adjusted human must have had a very happy childhood. Did you?
I mean, you know, it's interesting when you lose a parent, it's certainly, there's a period of instant appreciation, no matter how much they frustrated you in one way or another. And who are we kidding? Every relationship, the close relationship, is complex and has, you know, good stretches and bad stretches. But I am very appreciative. I have so much to be grateful for from both my parents. I think I did have a happy childhood in many respects. I was certainly cared for and well-loved, but I was also given something to push against that strengthened my muscles of who I wanted to be.
Wow.
Because I was quite different from I am very different from my mother in many ways. I hope to be like her best qualities, but I'm not a queen of quiet, gentle gestures. I'm a big old loudmouth who is comfortable asking for what I need. My mother, you know, was from a different generation, and she was less confident in that respect. I didn't actively rebel against my parents, but I recognized which parts of them I wanted to emulate and be like, and then which parts I wanted to sort of leave behind. And I, for the most part, was really supported in that, you know, defining of my own self. So yeah, it was definitely a fortunate upbringing, for sure.
Before we dive into your latest book, A Love Affair with the Unknown, Leaning into the Uncertainty of Modern Life, published by the House of Anansi Press, I want to talk about your podcast, which is where this all sort of started. Same title, Love Affair with the Unknown. When did you decide it was time to really take a deeper dive and turn this podcast into your book, A Love Affair with the Unknown? Can you tell us more about your brainchild?
Yeah, so A Love Affair with the Unknown is, in some ways, just even that sentence is what I've been living for the last couple of years. I went through a challenging illness, which, you know, I refer to in the book, and we may get to. It's sort of the medical mystery that drives the book. I made a very bold, some might say foolhardy, leap away from my steady, wonderful job at CBC Radio that I'd had for so many years. I took these leaps into new directions. And I'm just exploring that idea of what happens, how much we grow when we go through hard things, take on hard things, step outside our comfort zone. You know, life throws enough at us, enough uncertainty at us as it is. And yet to choose more, to independently say, you know what, I actually want to try this outside, you know, take a risk, take a leap. Some people would say it's crazy, but I have just found so much, excitement and growth and self-development in living that way. So I kind of found every way I could to express that. Mm-hmm. I had been working on the book through the course of the last couple of years. I knew I love interviewing people and have such a history, as you outlined, of conversations, but I wanted to sort of make that the focus of conversations now. I had wanted to try a podcast, and, you know, what would I do if I could do my own conversations? What would that interview show? What would that podcast look like? So, and then my Substack is also called A Love Affair with the Unknown, because I also am a writer and think having a regular outlet for reflecting on these themes, which are so relevant to all of us. You know, you don't have to go through a terrible loss or be quitting a job or have struggled with an illness to be feeling a lot of uncertainty right now. Yeah. And I find a growing community of people who want to rethink how we equip ourselves to handle it, and also to feel part of a community and recognize that everybody's muddling through hard stuff. And we all can, if we trust ourselves, we can summon the courage to get through and to, you know, take risks and to try hard things and learn along the way, no matter what. The podcast, the Substack newsletter, and the book are all tied around the same themes of finding hope and confidence and trust and community as we get through hard stuff.
And you're still connecting, which is one of your favorite things to do. You love to connect, and you're the world's best connector. I mean, yeah. we all know that. We all know that.
I can't help myself. Yeah, it's how I feel alive.
That's so great. I loved reading about how your earlier books were very sort of nonfiction, but when you found out about the Banff Literary Journalism Program in 2010, as you were just coming out of your first round of breast cancer, you applied and of course, got selected, and you spent a month in the mountains of Banff. How did that glorious time of writing that last book help you establish a daily writing habit?
What a good question. Yeah. So the Banff Literary Journalism Program is really a gift. So it's a 1 month program that these eight writers are selected, and you get everything is taken care of. Your bed is made. The food is in the cafeteria. You get out in the morning and you're given a writing space, a little cabin in the woods in this glorious setting of the mountains in Alberta. I mean, it's just so beautiful. Mm. And so the ability to commit to writing first, like that's number one. It allowed me to get into a routine, and then your mind starts to operate that way. You know, these patterns in our minds, I know you've talked, Judy, about neuroplasticity and you're interested in that, but that certainly was the case for me, that when I would start each day with this devoted time to this extended period in my little writing space in the woods to this creative exploration, my mind, as I was doing other things the rest of the day, or as I was sleeping in the evenings, ready for the next day, would start to, you know, percolate and give me material to, like, the cycle of creativity was well established. And so I definitely recognized the value of giving myself an outlet for writing, for creatively addressing whatever I was going through or thoughts I had. So I don't have that luxury now. I don't write every day the same way, but I do now know that about myself, that act of committing thoughts to the page is a part of me now. It's more of a regular habit that I still have going on.
Do you think it's also like the muscle memory, like just training that group of muscles to do it? You can just sort of come back to it as opposed to trying to discover it, right?
Yes. And because to that point, you know, when I go, like right now, I'm on busy with promoting the Love Affair with the Unknown book. And so I'm on a totally hectic, different schedule. And so I'm not writing every day. I write very seldom now. So it's kind of like, it's like creaky muscles. How do I do this again? And it's like anything, that muscle memory does come back once we get back into a habit.
It's like riding a bike, and we're going to get to the bike tour and that wonderful story too. But I also wondered, as I was putting this together, that because you have one of the most treasured voices in Canada, I was surprised that there isn't an audiobook version of this book yet.
Oh my gosh, me too. So many people have said that to me. Said, why isn't there an audiobook?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a question for my literary agent, I guess. But no audiobook. I might have to do one myself.
Yeah. That to me is like a no-brainer, because your voice that would be such a winner. Many of us are, I think everyone in the world is dealing with this right now. And you tackle it in such a thoughtful, intellectual, and compelling way. And I love when you write that, as Voltaire said, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd. You can hear him saying it with a French accent. And then you go on to write, it's a reminder too that although facing the unknown feels like a lonely condition, we're not alone in going through it. Can you speak to that?
You know, the genesis of this book was, as I mentioned, this unknown illness that I was dealing with. I had been through a lot of exercises in uncertainty before, whether it's from live broadcasting or having had breast cancer, you know, a couple of times. So I was not unfamiliar with uncertainty, but it was a whole new level with this, because cancer doctors have some answers for you. Once they figure out, oh, that lump, yeah, we know what that is. And here's the pathology and here's the treatment plan and here's what day you're going to feel nauseous and here's what it's going to look like. I mean, you kind of, it's a pretty well-traveled highway. This medical condition I was trying to figure out, I spent months and months not knowing what was the matter with me. Was I ever going to feel better? Why was I feeling like this? Would I become my old self ever again? All those questions. So that was kind of my front row seat to this subject matter of uncertainty. But I took comfort, I still do, I think in any uncertain moment, we can all take comfort in realizing so many people, whether it's illness, I think is almost a reminder, whether it's your own illness or someone else's, of our fallibility and that all of us have that vulnerability. We want so badly for things to go this way and to be just tickety-boo and kind of under control and just how we like them. So I found it helpful to remind myself and by virtue of writing the book, remind everyone else that none of us is ever alone in struggling, whatever our struggle is. It can feel so individual and nobody understands how painful it is that I just lost my mother or how fearful I am about never being able to get back on my feet again. But that's not true. You know, it feels like our situation is unique to us. And of course, in many ways, each of us is unique, but that experience of suffering and fear and unknown is just universal in one way or another. So I wanted to share that. And this whole book in many ways is a way of turning my own struggle through something challenging into something helpful for anybody going through something hard.
How wonderful was it when that kindly female doctor said, oh yeah, I know what it is. Go down the hallway to long COVID.
Long COVID. Yeah. It was 8 months of, you know, I saw this specialist and that specialist and this other specialist. And I mean, there were eight different ologists that I saw, respirologist, rheumatologist, cardiologist, you know, blah, blah, all the specialists, not knowing what on earth to make of my condition. And this was 2022, 2023. So long COVID was something that doctors were learning about. I mean, they probably still are here in 2026, but certainly then learning about in real time because we were still trying to make sense of COVID.
Totally.
And this lasting impact of it for some people was so new. Yes. So yes, after 8 months of seeing all these specialists and wondering what in the absolute hell is this and will anybody be ever able to fix me? This one doctor at a long COVID clinic said, oh yeah, no, I know exactly what that is. It's long COVID. And it was an interesting thing. I mean, as you point out, that moment was very, oh, hallelujah, because I wanted an answer. But no sooner did I have an answer than I was like, right back to the unknowable because she couldn't fix it. She couldn't tell me how long it would last. She couldn't tell me what it would mean for the rest of my life. She just gave it a name. So, and we cling to those answers. We want that in that clarity and security. Okay, so it's this. But then I went, okay, well.
Right.
So what?
Right, totally. It's like my son got into Harvard. Wait, now what? He's got to do it. So I also was thinking about how you had this year of not knowing. And I really pictured, and you talk about it, lying down, staring at a ceiling for many months. And you strike me as such an action-oriented person, an athlete, a walker, a person who can surf without even knowing what surfing is when your three sons are just natural athletes and knew how to do it. But that whole story in the book is lovely. You're in good shape. You love to work out. You don't like to be still and to be. So what got you through that period, really? That must have been very difficult. I really pictured that and had compassion for you lying there. What helped you get through that time, not only to survive it, but to actually to thrive from it?
Well, you know, and that became really the question. I would sit there in this great discomfort with one of the many symptoms or other kind of presenting, because long COVID does present with a whole whack of different symptoms. Everyone's case is so different, but fatigue was pretty universal. Mm. So I was lying there and I hit a point where I thought, okay, I don't want to be like this. But I also don't want to be spending the rest of my life wanting things to not be the way they are.
Right.
I kind of hit that wall of realizing okay, I hate this, but I also hate hating this, if that makes sense. I thought there's got to be a hack here. How can you learn to be okay with not being okay?
Yeah.
Was kind of my underlying query. And I do kind of explore this in greater length in the book, but I guess the answer to your question is, if it came down to the fact that if I can't run up and down the stairs or go ride my bike or go see a movie or just any simple thing that required energy and activity and muscle strength and all the things yeah. that I didn't have, if I can't do that, what do I have right here? Wow. And it was that act of shifting my mind. And in some cases, and this might sound dreadfully boring to high intensity, highly active people, but sometimes the pattern of light and shadow coming through the window that was reflected on the shiny floor, or the sound of conversations I'd hear of people on the streets passing by outside my window. I mean, I had to really slow it down and find what else is here. And I know how much meditation is a part of your life. And so you'll recognize there's a meditative aspect to that, is just being immediately present. In fact, I suggested at one point to my literary agent that maybe the title could be called "This Is Happening." And I don't like this. I don't like it. I don't like that this is happening. I don't like my headache. I don't like the tinnitus I hear in my ears. I don't like it, but it's happening. Yeah. So what do I do with it? And sort of examining it and deciding how much attention I want to give that discomfort. What else can I give my attention to? Like that pattern of light or the sound of children's laughter or something else. You know, my children playing, I have young adult children who were in and out of the house during that period, and the enjoyment of their company or the sound of them playing the piano. I mean, I had to really dial it right down to the most granular details.
Wow.
But it's an interesting exercise because you realize both things are equally true. You know, that pain in your stomach or that terrifying news headline, that crisis unfolding somewhere in the world that makes you anxious, you know, that is true. And so is the pattern of light flickering on your floorboards. And they're equally true. And they're equally as important as you decide they should be. And I've found agency in being able to decide which one I wanted to pay attention to. So I found agency in being able to do that, and then surprising comfort.
Right. You also talk about that, this in the book, I believe, about the two wolves, right? Which one are you going to listen to?
Yes.
The one that's really annoying and whatever, or right? Don't answer that just yet. When we come back, we're going to find out which of the two wolves we should listen to. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hey everyone, we're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio AM 740, and I'm here with acclaimed television and radio broadcaster and author Jill Deacon. And just before the break, I asked you, Jill, which wolf are you going to listen to?
Yeah, there's that old aphorism or a children's fable, but the idea of these two wolves in the forest, the good wolf and the bad wolf. And so the good wolf in this story would represent kindness and love and community and caring and patience and courage and all those qualities that we think of as good. And the bad wolf is fear and anxiety and cruelty and evil and whatever else. And there's these two wolves in the forest. Mm. And which one's going to survive? And the answer is the one you feed. Ugh. And so I love that you drew that example out, because it really is something I live by. I really try to live by that. And I try to feed the good wolf. Try. It doesn't always work, but I try.
You're also the good one. That helps because you see it. You quote many philosophers and brilliant people and authors. And I love that you talked about the book, Susan Jeffers' book, because I love that book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And this is also all related to David Blaine and how he spent 44 days in self-imposed starvation inside a transparent plexiglass case. What did you learn from David Blaine about how to feel the fear and do it anyway, and how to look at that sentence in a new way?
David Blaine, yeah, for people maybe recognize that name, he's of course maybe the most famous magician in the world. He has had his own Netflix shows, and he's the master of sleight of hand. He does incredible card tricks on the streets in New York City.
Yeah.
But he's kind of evolved to do these stunts that are just unthinkable. I mean, jumping off high towers and landing on a pile of cardboard boxes and hovering over a Grand Canyon with holding onto a hot air balloon. I mean, really terrifying feats. And I realized that a lot of the root of uncertainty for a lot of people, part of why it feels uncomfortable to think about all these crises happening in the world, is because it makes us afraid. Like, is something terrible going to happen that I can't handle? You know, is this going to impact the world in such a way that I should be afraid of? So there's a big element of fear to uncertainty. And I thought David Blaine was such I was like, let's figure that guy out. He's got a very different relationship with fear. He believes very strongly that we are capable of much more than we let ourselves experience. So I love that courage that he obviously applies to the work he does, and his faith in that, like his real belief, not just, hey, let's see what I can do, but absolutely believing that I can probably do this.
Wow.
And then the other thing is he thinks of fear as a lack of information. So he doesn't walk out one day and say, you know what, I'm going to jump off that 45 foot or meter tower. He works his way up, and all the while he feels the feelings. What is happening in my body? Is that my heart pounding? Is that my chest tightening? Is that my stomach clenching? Like, and he feels that and recognizes it and decides, okay, yep, I recognize that. And then he sort of helps himself override those fears and trust that he can do this, and he builds slowly up to being able to do the big feat. So I just thought there's a lot of wisdom in there. And the phrase, feel the fear and do it anyway, I think that I had always been the do it anyway person. Like I'd been, you know, a painting on the cover of the book, which is from a photograph of me jumping off a cliff and into water. But whether it's doing that or hosting live television or radio or doing something that seems scary.
Yes.
And I have the, I'll do it. I can do this. Sure. I'll pick me. I'll do it. And what I realized in thinking about David Blaine is that the do it anyway part is in some ways a flex if you don't do the first part first,
right,
which is feel it and understand what is happening in my body right now. Because when you get acquainted with those sensations in your body, you can see them for what they are, and they hold less power over you.
Yes.
And you can acknowledge them and say, okay, this is my body kind of doing the thing. And you can just sort of evaluate it more clearly.
Yes.
And almost honor those feelings. I hear you. I feel you. Now we're even stronger by deciding, you know what,
right,
we're still going ahead. And it's, I think that fullness of that expression made more sense to me after thinking about David Blaine.
This is so interesting because these are all like little tools in the tool belt that when you put them all together really make you feel stronger and make you feel okay with surrendering a little and not knowing and all of the rest. So I also loved that we see the signs that we need to see. Like, I always see the word bliss wherever I go. I just see the
word
bliss.
Of course you must.
It is, right? And you were walking along New York City and you write, and your writing is exquisite, by the way. I should just say this. Most people know this, but for those
Thank
that don't,
you.
check it out. You write, and I quote, "Bludgeoned by late day exhaustion and the oppressive summer heat. And I passed a sign in a store window that seemed written just for me. Courage," it read, "is a love affair with the unknown."
Yeah.
Oh my
That's
God.
That's where the title of the book came from. I love that. And it's true. When you think about it, that's what courage is deciding that I don't know what's going to happen, but I kind of love the possibility baked into that uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I trust myself that I got this.
So good. It's falling in love with uncertainty instead of resisting it, which is so much more powerful, right?
That's 100% right. Because resisting uncertainty, well, first of all, is a waste of time. Because it's literally everywhere. And also, you know, if we become too attached to our certainties, if you think about that, really what we're doing is cutting off possibilities that we don't know about, cutting off other perspectives.
That's
Certainty is a pretty short path to autocracy, a lack of empathy, a lack of patience. Mm-hmm. If you know exactly how you think everything should be, how could you not be missing? There's too many people and experiences and perspectives in this world for it to be ever possible that we know the right way for things to go. It just doesn't make sense. So, uncertainty is fearful in some respects, but it's kind of all in how we look at it.
Mm-hmm. It keeps reminding me of this book that Ellen Schwartz, the mom of, I don't know if you ever knew of Jacob Schwartz, who had Cadavan's disease, this beautiful boy who passed away at 21 years old, and he could never eat, he could never speak, he could never see, he could hear, and he loved music, and we're going to get to your music in a minute. And she wrote many books about him, Lessons from Jacob, but she also wrote a book, a children's book, and it was all about you have to walk through the puddle. Ellen's children's book is actually called The Puddle Jumper, and it was written by Beverly and Ellen Schwartz, two incredibly wonderful people. And it was written in order to help families in their healing journey of loss and grief. Most of us go around the puddle. We don't face it, but you've got to actually go through the puddle. It's messy. It's not so much fun. You're going to get wet, but that's the only way to get to the other side of the puddle, ultimately, right? In life, metaphorically.
Absolutely.
That sort of rang through to me as I was reading your book so much. I also love the synchronicity with the Wordle story that you tell. How you got the Wordle in 3 tries for the first time in weeks. That was crazy. And how cool was that when the word was worry?
Yeah, that was part of the sort of thread woven through the book of my mysterious ailment that I was trying so hard to figure out. And I used to be able to do the Wordle, and my brain wasn't working. And anyway, this one day that I was able to get it, the answer was worry. And I thought, okay, there's something here. Yeah, worry is so easy to, worry's like that sticky sort of Velcro, you know, worry's got Velcro all around it.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get it, for it to get attached to you and you to it. And you really have to consciously sort of separate yourself. This is something I had to learn going through cancer a few times, because boy, oh boy, you can worry yourself even sicker if you start to catastrophize about where's this going to lead and will I die tomorrow? Will I ever get to see my children's graduate? I mean, you can just send yourself down a worry train track, really picking up steam, going to nowhere good quickly. And so you have to really recognize worry when it starts to take over and say, okay, just no, not helpful. No worry before it's time. Let's just, look at those patterns of light in this immediate moment. This is happening right now. Yeah. I don't know what's happening tomorrow, but I can't worry about it right now.
And you're so right. That's meditation too, right? We don't worry about what's just happened or what's going to happen tomorrow. We're in the present moment awareness. And even if it's uncomfortable, we stay with it and we just let those thoughts, they may be whatever they are, be like clouds floating in the sky and just let them pass, right? You know, my husband, who's a physician, and always says 99% of what we worry about never happens.
He said he's a stoic philosopher, your husband.
And yet he's having surgery tomorrow in New York, actually, on his back. And he's very worried because he's a controller, right? He likes to control. So does worry give us the illusion of control? Like, what do we do it for?
What a great question. I think, I don't know why we worry. There must, well, actually, here's an answer. Here's what I think. I think there are two kinds of worry. There's productive worry, which yes. is this pain in my back that I keep having. Maybe it's something that I should get checked out. Yes. Oh, looks like I actually do need back surgery. Like that's productive worry.
Yeah.
This lump that I feel, oh, I maybe should get that checked out. Or, oh, this problem my child is having with dealing with their peers. Maybe we should get some help with that. Of totally. Course, there's nobody saying just sit and go, ha, everything's going to be fine. And of yeah. course, we have to be smart and proactive citizens in our world, for sure.
Yeah.
But the unproductive worry, which is maybe another name for anxiety, yes. I don't know, the catastrophizing and the fear-fueled worries about, oh, but maybe I'll never be able to walk again. And what if I can't walk my daughter down the aisle? I mean, those kinds of thoughts for your, you know, someone doing back surgery or whatever, you can let those, again, we can catch ourselves really being falling prey to unproductive worry.
Yes.
So I guess the evolutionarily, perhaps the idea of worry is part of how we've survived as a species to be able to think, well, hold on a minute. Maybe that's something I should, you know, that rash is something I should be concerned about. And sure enough, we get the medication and we get to stay alive. I mean, yeah. so worry has its place when it's productive. But I think there's so much more information coming at us in this digital world where we have 24/7 access to millions of sources of news and information, half of which may not be true. You know, it's just a fire hose coming at us. Yeah. And so that can fuel all kinds of worries about all kinds of things that aren't productive mm-hmm. and aren't helpful and are actually doing us harm.
Right. What a smart distinction. That's so good. That different kinds of worry. That is really, really incredible. I also love how you see the world in such an artistic, musical, and creative way. And of course, you are a musician and a singer, and we're going to talk about that. But it really permeates the book. So I have to quote this beautiful paragraph where you write, "Artists actively seek out the unknown to find what they don't even know they're looking for. Botticelli's Birth of Venus, Joni Mitchell's Clouds, Van Gogh's Starry Night, Bach's Cello Suites, all of Jane Austen, whatever art you love best, everything of beauty came from individuals who sat in uncertainty and played with it to see what would happen. You can't get the Mona Lisa by executing steps in a paint by numbers." Oh, it's so beautifully written. And then you go on to say that the art that appreciates unpredictability most of all must be jazz.
Yeah.
And I love jazz. Can you speak about the beauty? And I, oh, yeah, so much, oh. so much. Our daughter is a singer living in New York, but yes. And she is a singer, but she's a musical theater, opera, pop singer, but she loves jazz too. What do you love about jazz?
It's funny you say that about your daughter because my son also is a jazz musician.
Wow.
And I remember talking to him when I was sort of thinking about this book and exploring these ideas. And I was like, talk to me about uncertainty, because as a jazz musician, you have quite a different relationship with it. There I was, sick and miserable and wondering, what's the matter with me? And why can't I have it all mapped out? And then I thought, let's talk to a jazz musician about this, because that's a whole different way of looking at it. And I think I love jazz for the same reason I love improvisational sketch comedy, which I also talk about in the book, which is, I think there's something I appreciate as a listener of music or of, you know, comedy, almost of anything. I think even conversations as an interviewer, I like knowing that people are off script because it's so much more real in there, in that little spot when they didn't know exactly how they were going to get there. And when you hear jazz musicians and you know that they're all, I mean, obviously they have a rhythm that they've all agreed on and that they're listening more closely because they have to be attuned to one another. And there's just the sort of alchemy of what happens when that combination of doing the work, doing the preparation, you know, giving yourself that information about how to play every possible permutation on a scale or whatever, and then trusting your ability to handle it yourself and listen to where everyone else is going. And then somehow together, they all do that at the same time. And it makes this incredible sound. And it's the same with improv. Like nobody quite knows, well, how are we going to land this plane and how are we going to make it funny? And how are we going to include all the elements we're supposed to? And it's just, I feel extra impressed as an observer thinking, look what they did. And as a performer, having done improv myself, I feel extra engaged and alive, you know, trying to perform that way.
There's so much here. Like, I feel like we need to do 2 hours with you because like, it's so cool to me that you started off, you were in Peter Pan and in Annie when you were a little girl, you did musical theater.
Oh my gosh,
theater.
You've done your research. Wow. Yes, I was. Peter Pan. Boy, that was a while ago. I think I was 12.
And then there's improv, which is so, I mean, you've got to have a lot of guts and courage to do improv. We've had Colin Mochrie on the show and he said, the funniest is when you really take a risk and you go out to that apron of the stage and you just go for it. Sometimes it doesn't work, but
it doesn't sometimes work.
Right?
Yeah.
But the bigger you go, you know, it's like go big or go home. And so the fact that you've done improv comedy and the fact that you're a performer and you've done musical theater and pop and you've been in a cover band that I don't know if it's still, if you still play every Friday night.
We do. Yeah. Once a month.
And all the obvious things, journalist, four-time author, Substack writer, podcast host, singer, musician, and you were even a clown for a time. That's very cool because I know a lot about clowning. I have a friend who does that and it's not what people think it is. It's an art. To unwind, you love walking, you paint, you cook, you took up rug hooking. So what this all told me, Jill, is that you are really such a highly creative being. You really are, like, it just permeates all of you. Can you speak to this idea of being such a creative soul in every way? Where does this come from? Is this what drives you? We're going to go on a short commercial break. And when we come back, we'll find out what drives Jill Deacon and that creative spark and where it comes from when we return. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back and I'm here with author and broadcaster Jill Deacon. And just before the break, Jill, I asked you if you could speak to this idea of you being such a creative soul. Is that what drives you?
Yeah, I think creativity is, I am a big believer that creativity is in all of us. And in some ways, it's that same idea of just trusting that we can, tuning out those outside fears of, oh, what if it doesn't look good? And what if it's, and just knowing that the expression of it, really, really getting into the moment of expressing and trusting whatever comes. And it's not going to be a masterpiece every time or maybe at all. But the process is, I find it incredibly, it's like fuel. And it's a, you know, it's been a very, creativity is an incredibly powerful tool against anxiety and against suffering. I mean, when you're, listen, I, a lot of time when I was noodling around on my laptop writing because I didn't have energy to get up and do anything else, the ability to create something with words made the difference, all the difference.
Wow.
If I'm lying in my couch feeling lousy, but I could express to somebody, some future possible reader someday, what that lousy feels like in a creative way, then I've, as the poet Louise Gluck said, or you pulled this line in the beginning of the book somewhere, but writing is like a revenge against circumstances.
Yeah.
So any kind of creativity can be that way, you know, sketching, doodling, cooking up a melody and a song. I mean, that's just a revenge against circumstances and it's pretty empowering.
You are such a well-adjusted, healthy soul. You are. You're such a great role model for people. And I also wondered about, okay, a couple of things. I wondered how come you never, did you ever have the thought that you would pursue musical theater or a recording career? And what made you pivot into journalism?
I did years ago, like in my early 20s, I was auditioning. I auditioned for the National Theater School. I auditioned for musicals and stuff. And I did sing in a band, Bag of Hammers. It was a great band in Montreal. And we were, you know, I don't know, the band ended splitting up and went our different ways and stuff. But I did think that for a while that I was going to try to pursue these creative performing careers. But I also was always drawn, you know, I got my master's in education. I was also drawn to that feeling of, yeah, wanting to contribute, like wanting it to be more than just about me. In a way, this book feels like, I'm just thinking out loud here, but I think part of why I feel really good about this book is that it is something that I'm creatively proud of. But I think I'm most proud of the fact that it has value for other people. Yeah. I mean, I've heard from other people so consistently that it feels helpful for whatever stress or anxiety or fear that they have and that comfort. And I just feel deeply, deeply rewarded knowing that. So I guess, yeah, I did think of creative pursuits as a career, and I sort of stumbled into, I was doing improv sketch comedy and got contacted by someone from a radio station in Montreal who said, you know, live radio is improv, maybe you come work here. And it all just sort of fell into place. But wow. Yeah, life takes you on funny twists and turns.
You know, what you said is so powerful, because I believe that when you're living on purpose and in purpose, it often has to do with serving others, being in service. So I see why this is so meaningful, because it's so well written, it's so creative, it's so intellectual, it's so all the things, it's compelling, it's meaningful, but it's also helping people.
I do feel like I was able to, you know, it's like the revenge against my long COVID circumstances. I was able to, yes, make my bad experience be of service to someone else. So that's the best trick.
Wow.
There's the hack.
There's the hack. I love that. That's a good one. Have you ever thought, Jill, about doing a one-woman show where you would incorporate your comedy, improv, and your singing and your story, as it were?
Oh my gosh. I feel like, I don't know, do you want to be my producer? Let's do that. Maybe. That's a good idea. I had written a play at one point that I don't know, it's in a drawer somewhere, but maybe.
I see it.
I've never turned down a good idea, so I'm going to file that one. I like it, Judy.
I see it. I love your song, Where's My Baby Tonight?
And
I still can't believe you do all of this and do it
so
well.
My Skydiggers cover, yes.
Yes, and I'm hoping you'll sing us out of the show later on with that gorgeous tune.
Oh, gosh.
Not live by MP3
track. Not live, okay, good.
Yes. So we're going to do that as well. And I know we're getting towards the end and I have so much, but I want to say something else I loved about the book was you're talking about awe, and I'm spelling this for everyone, AWE, and awe walks in nature. And I just thought this was so aligned with bliss and finding your bliss. Can you tell us about, because what a beautiful part of the book.
I was thinking that you were going to probably talk about that, because it really is, you're right. And that's what finding your bliss can look like for anyone. You know, it's interesting. There's a book called, I think it's just called Awe, in fact, by an author. Wow, you should get him on the show. Dacher Keltner. I quoted him in my book a little bit. And he sort of does the work explaining the scientific benefits. I mean, the impacts on our well-being and tracing those to our neurochemistry from experiencing awe. And we think, a lot of us, when we hear the word awe, think, oh, to have an experience of awe, I mean, you have to, you know, fly to whatever, somewhere far away and climb Mount Everest and watch the sunrise or something. I mean, we think of these as being big undertakings that not all of us can access. But in fact, awe, as I mentioned earlier, that pattern of sunlight on my, you know, and shadow in my living room. I mean, awe is almost a mindset. Like I think it was Rachel Carson who wrote The Silent Spring, who talked about the idea of helping children appreciate nature by asking them when they're out, you know, if you're out with a little child, just that idea of imagine if you'd never seen this before, that feeling of looking at something, it could be anything,
yes.
You know, a hinge on a swing, like, I don't know, anything.
Yes.
If you've never seen it before, you'd have a real sense of, oh, look at how those pieces fit together and they swing back and forth, anything. And so going for an awe walk is, you know, something any of us can do wherever we are at any time of day. And just clearing our minds enough to really see what is happening around us and giving, sort of allowing reverence for some small things. Mm-hmm. There is so much beauty. There is so much kindness. There is so much. I try to notice sort of delightful things every day. Like, and it could be somebody standing up to offer another person their seat on the subway.
Yes.
I mean, just those small gestures of humanity and compassion and beauty and, you know, the bloom of a flower, the smells of flowers. It seems cliche to the sort of stop and smell the roses, but it's, you know, you can think of it as selfish because it's, you're giving yourself a gift every time.
Yes.
You do it.
Yes.
So awe is all around us and it's ours for the taking. And it really does all, and it lowers our resting heart rate. It calms our nervous
yes.
system. It gives us a sense of being part of something bigger than ourselves, which inspires us to take action and feel hopeful that we belong to this world and all these crazy things happening in it. Maybe we can take a small step to help remediate that. Like awe, allowing ourselves to experience awe is, you know, really has impacts on a whole bunch of levels. All good.
So good. There's so much. Oh my gosh. You beautifully describe a moment when writing the book, a shimmering light show, a flickering dance of brightness and shadow playing out in front of you, the morning sunlight. I want people to read it, but just the lasting gift of awe is in here and it's powerful, powerful stuff.
I like the idea too, that this is, I mean, just try it. You know, you can say, oh, I'm too freaked out about Trump and, you know, the Middle East. And I mean, okay, yes, that's all true. And what also is true, if you allow yourself, just give yourself a few minutes,
yes.
just lay those worries aside. They'll still be there when you want to pick them up again tomorrow.
Yes.
But just allowing yourself to see those smaller, simpler things, it's literally you just feel stronger and more able to handle.
Absolutely.
Everything.
It's a feeling good boost, I always call it.
It really is.
It's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. I wanted to ask you quickly about psychiatrist Norman Deutsch, who wrote the best-selling book, of course, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the idea that your brain gets better at whatever you choose to do. How has his work and the work of neuroplasticity helped you in your journey?
Oh boy, we need a whole other episode of your show for that. But
yes.
Because that was a very significant aspect of how I got better from long COVID. I will try to say quickly that the idea of neuroplasticity, I did some neuroplasticity training combined with cognitive behavioral therapy, sort of recognizing unhelpful thoughts and reactions to symptoms and experiences, and then recognizing how I had the ability to influence my physical feelings and also my response to those physical feelings. What story are we telling ourselves about what's happening right now? And so the idea of neuroplasticity, interrupting unhelpful thoughts. Oh, I'm so sick. Oh, I've had this headache for 2 months. Oh, I'm feeling this lousy, whatever. All those things might be true and are not helpful. So kind of interrupting them and redirecting.
Yes.
My neural pathways to focus on, hey, I walked around the block today, or hey, the sun is shining in this beautiful way, or hey, look at this. And I experienced a physical improvement in my well-being. And it was literally the process that led me to recover from all my long COVID symptoms. Wow. After 20 months
wow.
of feeling like absolute hell. No, neuroplasticity is so remarkably powerful. I wrote a little bit about this in the book, the idea, and this is a fun example. People can, if you think this is all made up, I mean, just try this. you look for a few minutes at a photograph. I did this in a workshop and we were all instructed on this Zoom workshop. Look at this photograph and then I'm going to take it away after a minute. And you have to tell me everything in the photograph that was red.
Red.
And so she took away the photograph and we all said, oh yeah, the flower was red and the t-shirt was red and the phone was red, whatever. And then she goes, excellent. Okay, now tell me things that were blue. And nobody could name a single thing because our brains had been sorting for red. We tuned out all the other things because we were focused on the red. And it was such an interesting illustration of how if red is fear and worry and terrible news headlines and achy, painful symptoms, you're going to keep seeing it. But if red is acts of kindness in the world or moments of beauty or signs of hope or positive possibilities, the more you see them, the more you see them.
Lovely.
So that's neuroplasticity at work too.
Okay, I have to just ask you this, journalist to journalist, because I was fascinated by this when you write about when the Mars Polar Lander failed, you were on live air and even NASA didn't know what happened yet. And you had 2.5 hours to fill. What does a journalist do when the only honest answer is we don't know? And what did you do?
It was crazy. We just had to, well, as I talk about in the book, you can't pretend. That's that moment where it's like, this is happening. You don't. You know, guys, we don't know what we're talking about. This is terrible. We can stretch. We can try to fill. We can try to analyze, try to sort of tap dance. I mean, we were stretching and stretching and stretching some more. And it was, oh boy, it was extreme and harrowing and also hilarious because at that point you have to laugh. You just have to say, everybody's watching because you're expecting this Mars Polar Lander to be sending images from another planet and there aren't any. And so now what?
Tell me, Jill, about Where's My Baby Tonight? What do you love about singing that song? And just like, you know, sort of set it up for us.
Okay, so a woman I know named Jane Gowan has a podcast called Music Buddy, and she herself is a musician and she has just conversations with other musicians. And I'm not a professional musician, but I love music and love singing. And she has certain songs and artists who've allowed her to use some of their material and given up the rights so that we could do a cover of one of their songs.
Nice.
And the Skydiggers is one of the bands that had given her that access. So the Skydiggers is a terrific Canadian band that I have loved forever. And their song, Where's My Baby Tonight, moves my heart for a lot of reasons. And I covered it with Jane. It was a lovely podcast where we did a whole interview about music and how it was a part of my life. And then at the end, we recorded this cover together and it was really a treat. So
without further ado, we're going to listen to Jill Deacon and her cover of Where's My Baby Tonight.
My baby slipped out of sight. Where's my baby? what you said there'll be no regrets over choice without you. My mistakes, no divorce.
So there is a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Jill Deacon?
Bliss for me is time alone in nature, listening and watching and observing patterns that I feel a part of, even though I'm an observer. Seeing the light shining through snow falling in a woods, the sort of sparkles in the snowflakes falling through the sun, and realizing that we're all part of nature. And that is just blissful to me.
The last line of your book, which I'm not going to give away, of course, it's in the acknowledgments, made me cry. I'll just say that for everyone. So beautiful and heartfelt. And I think that might have something to do with your bliss as well. Mm-hmm. It's been an absolute honor to sit down with you and talk to you. It's really been wonderful. Sorry,
Judy,
I'm getting emotional.
Can I say thank you too for what a careful and considered reading of the book, and what a really lovely experience to have a conversation with somebody who's put so much thought and appreciation into it. That means a lot. Thank you. I really, really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
You're good at what you do.
Thank you so much. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person, and she is like Jill Deacon, who's living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, mindfulness, or meditation expert, or anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you as well. We love to feature singer-songwriters and musicians on this show. So if you are a singer, please reach out to us. Also, what did you love about today's program? Are there any guests or topics you'd like us to feature? And for those of you who don't know, I'm also the Bliss Coach. That means I help you gain clarity, find your passion and purpose. And you can reach out to me at findyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. All you have to do is search up Judy Liebrack. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Jill Deacon, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kylie, producer Chelsea Lockstedt, associate producer Lori Quinn, Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yannizziello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. As well, thank you to Garrett Flores for the beautiful pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.